Praise be Jesus and Mary.
Now and forever.
The fundamental teaching of this account of creation that we heard is that God made everything that exists, unlike pagan myths of creation in which there is some pre-existing chaos which the maker of the world subdues and transforms. God began creation with nothing and made all things. Even the beautiful stars in the heavens, the sun and the moon are his creatures and not gods to be worshipped. The summit of visible creation is man, as the responsorial psalm also teaches. God made him little less than the angels, the angels are the only creature superior to him in nature. Like the angels, man is created in the image of God, capable of knowing and loving him as he knows and loves himself, and therefore capable of the beatific vision. Consequently, with the creation of man, material creation was no longer good, but very good. Man here means both sexes, male and female, he created them. The sexes are equal in human dignity because each is created in the image of God. Each is called to heavenly blessedness. Women are not half-baked men, as Aristotle thought, but they are specifically willed by God as the complement and helpmate of men. Sexual differences are therefore a gift of God to be received with gratitude. You have given him rule over the works of your hands, putting all things under his feet, the psalm says. God decreed, have dominion over the fish of the sea, the birds of the air, and all the living things that move on the earth. But because of sin, man, male and female, no longer perfectly exercises this dominion. Because he does not always obey God, God's creatures do not always obey him. Because sin has made us ignorant, we no longer know how to control all animals well, but only some of the easier ones, which we call domestic, and even these often do things that we don't want. Sin is the greatest problem in this world, but the Pharisees and the scribes who came from Jerusalem to check up on Jesus were worried about hand washing instead. Their concern was not sanitary, but ritual. The Mosaic law prescribed ritual ablutions to purify priests before they served in the temple. They had to be purified from their contact with the ordinary world, as a way of saying that they had to set their minds apart, purify their minds of every distraction before they went to serve God. The Pharisees had extended these ablutions to purifying oneself after returning from the market, where one might come in contact with pagans and other sinners, and these ablutions had become a tradition for them. They may not have been observed by all Jews, but Pharisees thought that if Jesus was zealous for the law, he ought to do it and make sure his disciples did it. Jesus, on the other hand, thought that people really zealous for the law ought to start with the Ten Commandments, which are certainly far more important than any human tradition. Traditions can be good, they can be neutral, they can be bad, and Jesus then points to one that was really bad, declaring that something was korban, that is, dedicated to God by vow. The vow was in general considered irrevocable, and so while the person who made the vow was still allowed to use the goods, others could not benefit from them, even if they were needy parents. Later rabbinic literature essentially agreed with Jesus and allowed one to be released from such a vow when it conflicted with one's duty towards one's parents, but you had to go to a rabbinic court and get a judge to decide that you could be released from the vow. But in Jesus' time, a stricter view was evidently prevalent. The lesson is that we should never allow minor issues to distract us from grave problems. First, get rid of the big sins, then worry about the lesser ones. God sent Saint Colette to fix problems that were both big and small. Where sin abounds, grace abounds all the more. And when the world is a mess, God invites people to become saints in order to fix it. When Saint Colette was born in France in the late 1300s, the world was not just a mess, or especially France was not just a mess, it was a complete disaster. By mid-century, the Black Death had reached its peak, sweeping across almost all of Europe, killing tens of millions of people, between 30% and 60% of the population, depending on the area. Society was devastated, and in particular, as far as religious life was concerned, the survivors found themselves exhausted. They'd made it through the disease, they'd survived the disease, but they were weakened, and so they were no longer capable of observing the rigor of the original rule, so they asked for and obtained mitigations of the rule. Then, if that wasn't enough, the Black Death, England and France were fighting the Hundred Years' War and fighting it on French soil. So the peasants suffered depredations from the soldiers. They stole, they raped, and when they had resistance, they murdered. In addition, the church was divided into two parts because it was not clear who was the real pope and who was the anti-pope. In France, people followed the one whom scholars would later identify as the anti-pope, but at the time, even saints like Saint Colette and Saint Vincent Ferrer were unable to tell the difference. That was the world in which Saint Colette was born, the only daughter of a 60-year-old carpenter who worked for the abbot of the monastery of Corbie. For many years, the couple was unable to have children. Then they prayed to Saint Nicholas, and a daughter was born, whom they named Nicolette or Colette, as a sign of thanksgiving to the saint who had given them the grace of having a child. About 15 years later, Colette's aged parents died, leaving her an orphan. The abbot took care of her and tried to find her a husband, but the girl insisted that she wanted to consecrate herself to God. She tried various forms of religious life, but nowhere could she find that intense prayer and penance to which she felt called. Finally, she decided to become an anchoress, which means that after a trial period, she was walled up in 1402 in a small cell attached to the parish church in Corbie. She had a window to look into the church, and she had a window to get food and pass out the waste from the cell, and she was going to spend the rest of her life there as a contemplative, as a hermit. One day, however, she had a vision, and in the vision she saw all the things that were wrong in the world, and especially what was wrong with Franciscans. And she saw Saint Francis come before the Lord and kneel down, and in the vision he begged, "Lord, give me this woman for the reform of my order." Because you know, the Franciscan order had been part of this vision. And to Colette's horror, the Lord graciously bowed his head in assent. So you know, the vision said that Colette had been called to reform the Franciscan order. But you know, here she was, a young woman shut up in a cell attached to a church. She couldn't really go out and do anything. So she talked to her spiritual director to try to discern what was going on, and her spiritual director decided that the vision was not real. It was something from the devil. It was just a temptation, because Colette was a hermit, and a hermit is higher than living the contemplative life together with other people. So since God never calls someone from a more perfect vocation to a less perfect vocation, the vision couldn't be from God, and therefore had to be from the devil. So she fought against the visions, which were repeated. There were little miracles in her cell, but they were passed off as demonic prodigies. She would get golden trees sprouting in her cell, and she would rip them up and tear them out and throw them out the window. And you know, things went on like this until eventually she became convinced that it really was God calling her, that her spiritual director was wrong. But she was still shut up in that cell. So after 2 years of living in the cell, a Franciscan friar came with one of the most powerful women in the world, Blanche of Genova, who was the sister of the woman who was thought to be the Pope in France. So with her authority, they freed Colette from her cell, and they took her to see Pope Benedict XIII, or at least the man called Pope Benedict XIII, who thought he was Pope but was not Pope. With his authorization in 1406, Colette began to reform monasteries of the poor clares. The key points of her reform were the austerity of life, the love of poverty, and of prayer. For love of poverty, for example, she wore the same habit for her entire religious life for over 40 years. Eventually, all the original cloth was replaced with patches. She was a woman covered with patches. The intensity of her prayer was such that she was sometimes seen surrounded by fire. One day, the nuns in one of these monasteries that she was reforming, the nuns saw a fire in their chapel, in their choir. And so they ran to put out the fire, but when they got there, the fire disappeared and they just saw Colette in the middle. Another time, a globe of fire came out of her mouth. On another occasion, she was in ecstasy for 15 days. So she had a very intense life of prayer, which sustained her work of reform. She was favored with the gift of miracles, with prophecy, with penetration of hearts. She could read what was on people's minds, and so she knew when someone was in sin and needed help, for example. She cast out demons, healed the sick, raised the dead. She gave life to over 100 children who died without baptism. She's also the only woman reformer of the Franciscan friars. Though this reform was of a limited extent, the only purpose of it was to make sure that there were enough friars to take care of her nuns. So, you know, after a good 40 years of this reform, traveling around France and even beyond France, the weariness of this long life that she devoted to her sisters, traveling from house to house to work on the reform, finally wore her out in Belgium at Ghent, and where she died on March 6th in 1447. Praised be Jesus and Mary.
Now and forever.